Hello. Good evening. Welcome to the Jewish Theological Seminary. I'm David Kramer. I'm the director of the library here. It is our privilege tonight to present not merely the next in our series of book talks for this year, but a distinguished author with a book that, speaking here as the librarian of JTS, is very close to my heart. I have to say two things about this by way of introduction and then introduce the author. Some of you may know, if you've read the book already, and I'm guessing that many of you have seen the term Geniza, and you've actually learned a lot about what the Geniza is. Actually, you need to understand two meanings of Geniza in order to make sense of this book, but I'll leave that to the author to comment on. And I often find myself, as I'm leading tours for people who are coming in to visit our rare collection, talking about the discovery of the Cairo Geniza and Solomon Schechter and the sisters and so forth. And what I do is I tell a story, but it's merely a story. Imagine my pleasure when I opened up this book and found myself not only in a story, but immersed in a world that allowed me to feel as though I was face to face with Solomon Schechter and the others who were engaging these questions and discovering this Geniza. Really quite extraordinary. So I have to say that since my reading, my experience of the Geniza will never be the same, or at least of the stories that led to it. What are we perplexed about these days? A lot of things, I suppose, but one of the things that I imagine most perplexes us is what we retain and what will be lost. Though I imagine that's an eternal human question. Talk about retaining and losing, right? One of the ways we do that is on a device that looks like this. Please turn yours to silent or off right now. But I like to show people that I have actually on this phone a more complete classical Jewish library in its original languages than anybody, Jew or non-Jew, had in their entire library before the year, say, 1850. And I downloaded it for free. So there's a big difference, what we have access to, what we can remember, what we forget. As a librarian, I've got to tell you that one of the most extreme anxieties that we have as we digitize everything, I know you've heard that nothing disappears anymore, it's always eternally findable. Well, when you've tried to click on that link and find that it's a dead link and realize that the site to which it was linked has long since disappeared and will never be recoverable, what you appreciate is that what we think is eternal is not that at all. And yet, sometimes there are accidental discoveries, memories that we didn't know we could have again, such as in the Cairo Geniza, that all of a sudden bring back a world. If you've read this book, you already know what I'm about to say. If you haven't, what I would say is quite simply to encourage you, because you will find yourself introduced to and immersed in worlds, both contemporary and past, that are as complete and alive and challenging as any worlds you find yourself in the everyday, and asking questions. Questions that perplexed our ancestors and questions that perplex us. I could mention that our author went to Prosdor, which is one of the things that the Jewish Theological Seminary is proud of in connection. So I have to say that. I just did, right? She just shared with me that one of her children is going to Camp Ramah for the first time this summer, right? Okay, all good. We were able to compare which synagogues our families belong to in nearby New Jersey. Also good, right? More important than anything else, we will have the privilege of listening to fresh insights about a book that has many of them. So, Dara Horn.
I want to say thank you to David and everyone at JTS who was involved in inviting me here this evening. I want to say that this position is one that I feel very comfortable in. I don't mean being in front of an audience, but I mean being at the Amud, because I should say that my very first job long before I became a writer was as a Torah reader. So this is like my most comfortable place to be. You heard a little bit about me in David's remarks, but you didn't hear the most salient fact of my current life, which is that in addition to writing novels, I'm also the mother of an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 1-year-old. So I want to say that it's very rare in my house that anyone ever actually listens to me. So I'm saying this to say thank you to all of you in advance, not only for coming tonight, but for listening to what I have to say, which is a very rare experience for me because no one ever listens to me at home. I want to begin by saying that this is a book that in many ways started in this building. Not only because of Solomon Schechter and the parts of the Geniza collection that he, of course, brought with him to New York, which I'll talk about in a moment, but for a much more personal reason. I did go to public school growing up, and after my bat mitzvah, a great part of my Jewish education did take place here at JTS in the Prosvar program, where my parents drove me from New Jersey every Sunday for 6 years. They only drove me for 6 years. Between my siblings, it was probably more like 15 years. And where a key part of my Jewish education took place during Prosvar's bagel break. And I would say, don't want to mislead you, this was not because of socializing, because I was from New Jersey and didn't know anyone, and I was very afraid of all of these children who had grown up in Manhattan. But the result was, since I had no one to talk to, I spent bagel break down the hall in the diaspora's biggest library. And it was there that I first discovered this, not the Geniza itself, because I wouldn't have known how to ask to look for rare books when I was 12, but I rather found myself in this metaphorical Geniza, which was this storage room of the Jewish past. So this, I see this book very much as growing out of my Prosdor experience. In honor of JTS, I also would like to start our conversation with, not specifically about my book, but with a few words about what makes something a Jewish book. Because this is something that I've had a lot of occasions to think about over the past 11 years of my life. Guide for the Perplexed is my fourth novel, and all four of my novels deal with themes from Jewish history and religion. And ever since I published my first novel 11 years ago, I've often been invited to participate on panels at Jewish institutions, where I'm always invited, where there's always like me and two other writers who have also written books on Jewish themes. And invariably, there is a moderator there who, without fail, will ask one question: do you consider yourself a Jewish writer? What then happens, as many of you know who have like gone to these panels and seen this happen, is the other two writers on the panel will say, no, 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 I'm not a Jewish writer. At which point I'm thinking to myself, like, why are we all sitting here in a JCC? So there's a lot that we can say about, and to be fair, it is an open question of like what makes someone a Jewish writer. You know, is it whether what makes something a Jewish book? Is it whether the writer is Jewish? Is it whether the characters are Jewish? Is it something about the sensibility? But having participated on these panels for 11 years, I actually have a definitive answer of what makes someone a Jewish writer. What makes someone a Jewish writer in America today is their likelihood of being asked to participate in a panel during which they will be asked this question: do you consider yourself a Jewish writer? So I think by that standard, I qualify. So this is what Jewish writers in America are now. But as you probably gleaned from this introduction, I'm in addition to being a writer, I'm also a professional nerd, by which I mean I have a doctorate in Yiddish and Hebrew literature. And one of the things that you learn when you do a doctorate in Yiddish literature is that no one ever asked the great Yiddish writer Sholem Aleichem, do you consider yourself a Jewish writer? And you know, we can laugh about that, but the reason that no one ever asked Sholem Aleichem this question is because if you ask that question in Yiddish, it doesn't make sense. Because as it sounds like some of you realize, the word for Jewish in Yiddish is Yiddish. The word for the language, the religion, the identity, the culture, it's all the same word. So if someone had said to Sholem Aleichem, do you consider yourself a Jewish writer? I think his answer would be, well, duh. Like, I'm writing in Yiddish, that kind of makes me a Yiddish writer. And while we can laugh about this, I think that it reveals something really important about what Jewish literature used to be. Jewish literature didn't used to be about whether or not the writer was Jewish, or whether or not the characters were Jewish, or like whether there's like someone in your book who's eating a bagel. What used to make somebody a Jewish writer was that they were writing in a Jewish language. Whether that language was Hebrew or Yiddish or any one of the 20 Jewish languages that have existed over world history, and I'm sure there's someone in this room who knows the accuracy of that number, but I believe it is 20. And we are in a very unusual situation in the Jewish community in the United States today, or I should say really in North America today. We are in, this is one of the largest Jewish communities in world history, but this is a community that doesn't primarily use the Jewish language. This is a community that primarily uses English. And I would say that this matters a lot, because not just because of the words that we're using, but because every language has an archaeology of belief that's built into it, which native speakers of the language may not even hear. When you're speaking English and you say to someone, "Oh, go the extra mile," you're not thinking to yourself, "I'm quoting the Gospels." But of course you are. This is what Jesus says to his disciples, that I will go 1 mile beyond where you've gone. When you say to somebody in English, "Oh, this will happen for better or for worse," you're not thinking to yourself, "I'm quoting the Anglican marriage ceremony." But of course you are. And of course, in Jewish languages, those kinds of references are drawn from the Torah, from the commentaries on the Torah, from the Mishnah, from the Gemara, from centuries of texts that are drawn from this question of the covenant between man and God as described in the Torah. So I think that that's, and that archaeology becomes so profound that it shows itself in even the most trivial of ways, in the most secular of literature. I'm reminded of a short story by Shalom Aleichem, actually a very long short story, but a short story by Shalom Aleichem, which is about an insurance fire, when someone burns down their own failing business in order to collect the insurance, which is actually something that happens a lot in Yiddish literature. And that could be a subject perhaps of some other lecture at another time. But what is interesting to me about this incident is that there actually are multiple expressions in Yiddish for describing insurance fires, because apparently this is such a common thing. In this particular story, Shalom Aleichem uses my favorite expression in Yiddish for describing an insurance fire, which is lighting Shabbos candles in the middle of the week. So this archaeology of the language, I think, is something that it's what contributes, I think, to the feeling that many people have of the kind of a thinness or an inauthenticity to the American Jewish experience. That sense of thinness and inauthenticity is often mistakenly thought that it's due to a lack of historic roots. I can tell you, having written my last novel about the Jewish spies in the Civil War, that there's no lack of historical roots. The thinness that we feel, I think, comes from the lack of that language. And what I've tried to do in my novels to address this is, in a sense, to write in English as though English were a Jewish language. And what I mean by that is not that I write books with a bunch of words in italics, although many writers have done that to greater or lesser effect. But what I mean is that I write novels in English where the references that are built into the language of the text itself are drawn from Jewish religious sources. Some readers will recognize them, some readers won't. But for the most important ones, every reader, no matter what their background, eventually will get to the point in the book where those references are revealed for what they are. The easiest way to describe this with my novels is with their titles. My first novel was about a photographer. It was called In the Image, a reference that was probably equally known to Jewish and Christian readers. Not so much for my next few novels. My second novel was about the theft of a Chagall painting from a Jewish museum during a singles cocktail party. It was called The World to Come, which, of course, a reference to the Jewish ideas of the afterlife. But to my non-Jewish editor, was a beautiful turn of phrase, until she got to the part of the book where it was more than a beautiful turn of phrase. My third novel was about Jewish spies in the Civil War, and it starts with an undercover northern soldier poisoning his own uncle at the Passover Seder by putting poison in the fourth cup of wine. And that book was called All Other Nights, a title which, if you see it at Barnes & Noble, some people will immediately know what that is and some people will not. But everybody eventually is going to understand what this means. And of course, my newest novel is Guide for the Perplexed, which I'll speak about in a moment. Since I was a child, I've had a fantasy of turning life into an archive. And I think this is a common writer's fantasy. I had this desire to sort of record everything that I was experiencing, or that I heard about, and to write everything down in all these journals and diaries and notebooks and everything, because I had this idea that if I could write everything down, then nothing would ever be lost. Now, of course, social media has made my dream come true. and turned it into a nightmare where every idiotic thing you ever do is recorded forever. And I will say to David Kramer, who says that he's not sure about, he says that it's not really true that everything's recorded forever, I would say call my husband, who is an expert on data spoliation. He's the person who goes into the server and excavates the thing that you thought that you lost. It really is still there. But now we all kind of live in this sort of fantasy nightmare where there is this, at least this potential of everything being recorded forever. And I think we often think of this as a kind of a hyper-modern problem. But because I had this vast background as a professional nerd, going back to my days at Prosdoor, I did know that that this wasn't the case and that this question of data dumping had come up before. In 1897, a Cambridge professor named Shalman Schechter discovered a vast trove of medieval of Jewish documents in a synagogue in Cairo that dated back to the Middle Ages. The story of how he discovered this trove is a tale in and of itself, which I could give a whole lecture on, but just to let you know who he got the tip from about these documents in the Geniza, he first got the inkling of this idea of where the Geniza, of what the Geniza was from acquaintances of his in Cambridge, two Scottish Presbyterian widowed middle-aged identical twins. And these were these two incredibly gifted women who had been trained in classical languages and who had, their father had had inherited a vast sum of money, and he had told them he would use the money to take them to whatever country they wanted to go to, provided that they learned the language first. And so they quickly acquired many, many languages. And when they got older, they became what was known in the Victorian period as Bible hunters. And what that means is they go off on these Indiana Jones-like expeditions to find the earliest manuscripts of church documents. So what they had done on their greatest Bible adventure was they went to the monastery at the foot of Mount Sinai, where they knew there was a vast trove of Syriac documents, Syriac being a language similar or maybe even identical to Aramaic. See, there are people in this room who know this way better than I do. So this was, of course, not only the language we know as a rabbinic language, but of course the language that Jesus spoke. And they found in this archive at the foot of Mount Sinai the oldest Syriac version of the Gospel according to Mark. It was exactly like the Gospel according to Mark that we know today, with two small details that were different. In this version, there was no virgin birth, and there's no resurrection. Otherwise, it was exactly like the Gospel of Mark that we know today. So they brought this document back to Cambridge, they translated it, they became world famous, and then they sort of just continued going back to Egypt to see what else they could find. And at one point, somebody started selling them Hebrew manuscripts on the street, and Schechter took a look at these manuscripts, noticed the rarity of these items, and sort of figured out eventually that the person who was selling these documents on the street was in fact the janitor at the synagogue where this Geniza was, and who was basically scraping them off the top and selling them for money. So this is the sordid tale that leads to the discovery of the Cairo Geniza. As probably almost everyone in this room probably knows, the custom of the Geniza comes from the religious law against discarding any document that has God's name in it. What was unusual about the Cairo Geniza is that they had the custom not only of saving any document with God's name, but of saving any document that was written in Hebrew letters. So we're talking about things like grocery lists. And not only did they have this custom of saving absolutely everything, but they also had a habit or a custom which I personally can relate to from my own basement and garage, which is that they had not emptied their room-sized Geniza in over 900 years. So when Schechter finally got the attention of the Grand Rabbi of Cairo, convinced him to, found favor in this man's sight by doing things like taking Arabic lessons from his brother and bringing him stamps for his stamp collection from England. Once he had found favor with this Grand Rabbi of Cairo, he was able to have access to this Geniza. And he describes this in his memoirs of the experience, where he took a ladder up to the second floor where they had a hatch that was the only access to this Geniza, because of course the door at the bottom was blocked up by this Collier Brothers-like hoarding. And so he went up to the top, opened this hatch, looked down, and saw beneath him a cloud of dust. And underneath this cloud of dust was a sea of loose paper 20 feet deep dating back to the 900s. So I don't know what you would do if you had found yourself in this situation, but if you were a typical British imperial, you would do what Schechter did, which was, you know, what everybody gallivanting around the British Empire would do, which is pack up everything that you could find and bring it back to Cambridge. I should say that he did not only pack up all of these papers and bring them back to Cambridge, but something even weirder, which is one of the, something else that he brought back with him, was another thing that he found in the Geniza that wasn't paper, was six large wooden panels that were part of the synagogue that had been damaged in some way, and that were sitting in the Geniza. And Schechter also brought these back with him to Cambridge, and not only to Cambridge, but he also brought them with him to JTS when he became the president of JTS in the beginning of the 20th century. At JTS, he commissioned a carpenter to have these six wooden panels built together into an ark, which was known by some critics as the Frankenstein arc, and which he then was then used for decades at JTS, and it later was given or sold to the Jewish Museum across town. One other panel, the actual door of the Aron Kodesh, of the ark from this synagogue in Cairo, had an even more peculiar fate. In a story that is so weird that I could never put it in this book because it would not be plausible in fiction, this ark door from this 1,000-year-old synagogue ended up at an estate sale in Florida, where in 1990 somebody bought it for $37. That person then sold it to Yeshiva University Museum for, as a curator there put it to me, upwards of $37. And you can now see it, actually right now it's on display at Yeshiva University Museum on 16th Street. So there's actually this kind of Ben Ezra triangle in Manhattan between here and the Jewish Museum and the Yeshiva University Museum. So I'm glad to be what I see as the apex of the Geniza triangle in Manhattan. So my novel is one that you can judge by its cover. It is a book within a book within a book. On the outside, it is about a woman who creates the next generation of social media. She creates an app that records everything that its users do and catalogs it all according to their instincts. Those of you who have read my other books know that I'm a little bit obsessed with injecting forgotten history into a plot worthy of an airport novel. Which is why this particular software developer ends up getting kidnapped in post-revolutionary Egypt. Because, like, that's what happens to software developers, right? So that's what happens in this novel. And that also makes this novel one of the first American novels about the Arab Spring. Not because I'm so incredibly prescient, but rather because I started writing this novel before the Arab Spring, and then I was incredibly annoyed when they overthrew their dictator, because it meant that I had to change my plot. But it also meant that I had an opportunity to confront a really astonishing historic moment when one of the world's oldest civilizations was suddenly forced to face a new world where everything was going to be on the record. Part of my book takes place in the Library of Alexandria, as we continue the nexus of libraries. The Library of Alexandria, which some of you may recall from fourth grade social studies as the largest library in the ancient world, and which of course later burned to the ground. What you did not learn in fourth grade social studies is that the Library of Alexandria was rebuilt 10 years ago as a $200 million complex. And part of this $200 million complex are servers that have the world's only backup of the Internet Archive. The Internet Archive being the record of every web page ever created. Sort of like how the pharaohs had to be buried with all of their organs perfectly preserved. Sort of like this is a culture where nobody believes that you can't take it with you. And that continues to this day. So that is the external story on the outside frame of the book. This story about this kidnapping plot. But the story inside the kidnapping plot is about this software developer and her relationship with her extremely jealous sister, and how the acrimony between these two women ends up altering both of their lives in ways that they could never have expected. This story, I should say, is directly inspired, as is really part of the kidnapping plot story, this story is very much inspired by the biblical story of Joseph and his brothers, retold in contemporary times and with women characters instead of men. I think it's deeply important that many of the world's oldest stories are about sibling rivalry. Not because it's true that mom always loved you best, although maybe for you it is, but rather because siblings are people who share a past, but not necessarily a future. And I mean many things by that, but one of the narrower meanings of what I've just said is that siblings are people who grew up in the very same environment, but when they look back on that environment, their memories, and share those memories, you would probably never know that they had grown up in the same house. Sibling relationships are something that I'm very personally familiar with, not only from my own children, but also because I have two sisters who also are published writers, and a brother who is an animator who this year won his second Emmy. So we grew up in this kind of creative collective, and our parents did a few things to turn us into creative people, and if any of you have children or grandchildren, I actually don't know that I would recommend any of these things. The first thing that they did that turned us into creative people is that we traveled a lot. They would take us on these epic trips, and not to places where you might think to take four children, but places where, of course, you would take four children, like Cambodia or Peru. Like, it wasn't a vacation unless everyone had to get a shot first. And my parents very quickly realized that they were going to have to develop a management technique to prevent us from beating up the flight attendants on these long-haul flights. And so one thing that they did was they told each of us that we were required to keep a journal of these trips. And I took this very seriously, and I really tried to write down everything that we were experiencing. And today I'm very grateful to my parents for making me do this, because I can look back at these journals and not only see what it was like to be in China, but to see what it was like to be 12. So I'm very grateful for my parents for doing this, although now as a parent of four children myself, I cannot imagine how they did any of this, which is why I would not recommend it. The second thing that they did that turned us into creative people was that they quickly found out that they needed to develop a management technique, not only for these long-haul flights, but also just for being at home around the dinner table, where my siblings and I were constantly interrupting each other, never letting anyone finish a sentence. No one ever was willing to listen to anything anyone else had to say. So one day my mother got so annoyed with this that she came home from work with a big kitchen timer. She put this on the table and she said, "From now on, each child will have 5 minutes to tell about his or her day. Anyone who interrupts that child will have time deducted." Well, the first result of this policy is that I now speak very quickly. So I'm sorry if your ears can't keep up with my mouth, and this is entirely my mother's fault. But the second result of this policy is that my siblings weren't about to put up with this idea that they couldn't offer their running commentary on everything that you were saying about your day at school. So one of my sisters elegantly solved this problem by passing out pencils and index cards to everyone at the table. And people would then write down numbers and hold them up while you were speaking, rating your day. Like, your day gets a 2.3, your day gets a 1.5, your day, sort of like at the Olympics. And I think that when people are holding up signs while you're speaking saying, "Your day stinks," it makes you very aware of what it means to tell a story and keep an audience engaged. So these were things that my parents did to turn us into creative people. Like I said, I don't know that I would recommend any of these things. But I will say that during this process, dinner at my family's house became something like an ongoing series of five-minute comedies, five-minute operas, five-minute tragedies, sort of like an ongoing five-minute gong show or American Idol. And in these dinners, my siblings really taught me what happens to days that disappear. If you're unlucky, they end up on a server somewhere, or perhaps in a dusty room in Cairo or in the JTS library. That's the unlucky ending. And if you're lucky, they turn into stories. The Jews of medieval Cairo had an excuse for saving every piece of paper and every evidence of their daily lives. They believed that their language was infused with a kind of holiness. Even the NSA has an excuse for saving every aspect of our lives. My question for us is, what's our excuse? What reason do we have beyond narcissism for Facebooking, tweeting, Instagramming every second, every moment of our lives? What is it about this data dumping that we find so necessary and also so compelling? I think it's a fear of mortality. The Egyptian pharaohs used to arrange for themselves to be buried in tombs which had records of images and texts and models of everything that they wanted to bring with them from one world to the next. I think that we similarly hope that if we could just save everything, then all of our momentary encounters could somehow also be preserved. So much of what we record online are fleeting experiences. Have you ever noticed, and maybe this is just what I see online, and maybe it's a reflection of who I hang out with, but I don't think so. Have you ever noticed how many people post pictures online of food? Like, here's this lunch that I'm about to eat. Here, look at my beautiful dinner that I just made. You know, these like pictures of food. And I used to always wonder, like, why are there always people putting pictures of food up? And eventually I decided that the reason people were doing this is because this beautiful meal that they just spent all this time making is very quickly going to become a pile of dirty dishes that someone is going to have to clean up. And I think that a lot of the things that people choose to post and share on the internet are these fleeting moments. So the things that people share and save are the delicious dinner that's going to turn into a pile of dirty dishes, or the glowing sunset that's going to fade into darkness, the laughing man or woman who's going to probably leave us for somebody else, the smiling parent who's going to pass away, the crawling baby who's going to start to walk. We want all of those moments to remain forever unchanging, stored for eternity in some kind of metaphysical space beyond time. And I think that that's why we call it the cloud. I think that what's lost in that cloud is the art of forgetting, the selective memory that distinguishes trash from treasure. My parents spent 30 years as avid snapshot takers. Notice I said avid, I did not say good. But they had these a passion for taking pictures. And in my parents' house to this day, there's two floor-to-ceiling bookcases that are just all of their photographs of 30 years of our family's adventures together. It recently occurred to me that if my husband and I were to print up every picture that we have taken of our four children, that the results would easily fill a room, which might not be such a bad thing, except that our oldest child is only 8. Saving everything, it turns out, is eerily similar to saving nothing. And in sheer quantity of data, many of our personal lives may come to resemble that room in Cairo, bottomless wells of mostly trivial information, with their treasures concealed in a cloud. This book is called A Guide for the Perplexed, which is, of course, as many of you know, named after a famous work of Jewish philosophy whose rough drafts were found in that Geniza in Cairo. Its author, Moses Maimonides, or as I can call him in this room, the Rambam, was not only a leader of the Jewish community and an extremely important philosopher and leader of Jewish thought, but he also was a scientist. He lived in 12th century Cairo, and he was published many scientific books in addition to his works on philosophy and Jewish law. And not only was he publishing scientific books, but he also was practicing as a doctor. And not only was he a doctor, but he was a doctor for the Sultan of Egypt. He was the chief physician to the Sultan of Egypt. So this was not just a doctor. This was Dr. Oz. So I think that we often think about something like when we think of the 12th century, we have this desire to believe that these people lived so long ago that it's like, you know, they weren't even really people yet. And I think that what's important to remember is that everybody thinks that they're living in modern times. And this is true for, and I think this is important for us to remember. And, you know, I hope, you know, I very much pray that in 50 years, people look back at perhaps some of the ways that we are treating illnesses and say, like, oh, what idiots they were, like chemo, what were they thinking? And I very much hope that that's true, in the same way that we look back on these people and we're like, bloodletting, what were they thinking? But I think that when we think about what it means to live in modern times, it's important to remember that at the time when Rambam was living, the time of Maimonides, the place where he lived in Cairo in the 12th century, this was the tech capital of the world. This was a city that was at the crossroads of a global economy. It was on science's cutting edge. And in his book, Guide for the Perplexed, he asks the same question. He asks many, many questions, of course. But he asks, one of the questions that he asks is, to me, the same question that so many of us are asking today. Are our lives determined by forces beyond our control? Or do we have the free will to determine our own future? For Rambam, this was a religious question about an omniscient God. And it's a question, of course, it's a dilemma that goes back very far in Judaism. It's articulated, actually, and the first time I ever learned it was for my graduation from Prosdor. I had to present a Dvar Torah on a Mishnah. And the one that I did was from Pirkei Avot, which was HaKol Tzafui B'Harashut Netuna, which is, it says in Pirkei Avot in the Mishnah that that everything is foreseen yet freedom of choice is granted. So this is a very old paradox in Judaism about how is it possible that people have free will? Because of course we have to have free will, because otherwise what would be the point of the Torah? Like, what is the point of being commanded if we don't have any choices? But at the same time, how is it possible that we have free will if we have an omniscient God? To me, though, this is not just a religious or a theological question, because today I think it's mostly secular people who believe that their lives are predetermined. They don't believe that their lives are predetermined by God, but they may believe their lives are predetermined by things like genetics or brain chemistry or laws of evolution. So I think that this question of how much of our lives are subject to free will is a very, very open one. And I think that question of free will versus fate is something that only can be solved by storytelling. And what I mean by that is by the stories we tell ourselves, that we choose to tell ourselves, in a sense, about why our lives have turned out the way they have. My novel is a rewriting of the Joseph story from the Torah. And that story exactly captures this dilemma. Joseph has the ability to see the future through dreams, both his own dreams and in interpreting other people's dreams. And at the very beginning of the story, he predicts that his brothers will someday bow down before him. But other than this interpretation of dreams, nothing else supernatural happens in the Joseph story. At least nothing explicitly. This is not a story like many others in the Torah where God is coming down and smiting people. None of those things happen. Everything appears to be happening through human agency. His brothers are jealous of him. They sell him into slavery. He works in the house of a powerful man whose wife starts coming on to him and frames him for sexual assault. He ends up in prison. He decides to help two other prisoners interpret their dreams. It kind of goes on like this in this series of events, ably recounted in the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. And you can read that story the way that Andrew Lloyd Webber did, as a story that really is not about God at all, and is all about sort of like, you know, somebody working their way to the top. And what I think is amazing, though, is that at the end of the way the story ends in the Torah, at the end of the story, of course, there's the famine. He's been put in charge of this food rationing program. His brothers come to Egypt to buy food and end up confronting him. He reveals himself to them. And when he does, he says something really amazing. Joseph says to his brothers, when he finally identifies who he is, he says, "Don't be angry at yourselves for selling me to this place, because it was to save life that God sent me ahead of you." Now, if you ask me, that is a mind-blowing revision of history. It's sort of like, hey, brothers, remember that heinous crime you committed against me? Don't worry, it's all good. It was just a benevolent act of God. I mean, to me, this seems incredibly unjust. But what I think it really reveals is Joseph's true power, which is not his sort of kooky or at least supernaturally unusual power to predict the future, but rather the power that he shares with all of us, which is his power to control the past. Not his power to change the past, which none of us can do, but his ability to control the past by choosing to tell the story of the past selectively in a way that makes a future possible. In my novel, the stories of Maimonides, the philosopher whose work was left in the storage room, Shalman Schechter, the professor who found it there, and my main character, the kidnapped software genius who stores every fragment of our lives, all of these three stories converge in this novel to reveal that ancient human power. The way we control the past is not by recording everything, but by curating our memories, by choosing out of that bottomless well of information what's worth remembering and what's worth saving. And it's that act of choosing that turns a lifetime's worth of memories into something as meaningful as a story. Thank you all for listening, because no one listens to me at home.
Sure, of course.
Shall we? I mean, I'll say I'm happy to take questions, and in case people are too afraid to take questions, may I encourage you by saying that the first two people to ask a question will receive a free toy. You can tell I have little kids at home, because I think that this would be appealing to people I talk to on a daily basis. You will receive a free toy. This is because it's a guide for the perplexed. It is a puzzle. Because it takes place in Egypt, it forms a pyramid if you can solve the puzzle. So, who is my first person to receive a prize? It is you. Thank you.
I'll bring it.
Thank you. Say it again. I'm sorry.
Was Solomon Schechter really a twin?
Okay, the question is, thank you, and you win a free prize. Thank you very much. Do you have other writers who come to this series who give free prizes? I didn't think so. This is the first time. You should tell people. This is a great idea. All right, I'm glad you're... congratulations on your prize. The question is, was Solomon Schechter really a twin? The answer is yes! Solomon Schechter really was a twin. And let me explain where this question comes from. So in my novel, of course, as I mentioned in my remarks, this book is very much about sibling relationships. There's these two siblings, the software developer and her sister, are the main characters in the contemporary story. I initially intended to write this story just as a contemporary novel, because my last novel, as I mentioned, was about Jewish spies in the Civil War. And when I went around the country doing book tour events for that book, I found that people would come to my events in costume. Like with muskets and like their gear and everything, and like they'd set up tents in the back, and I have to tell you that at first I thought this was like, I remember like going to one event where the guy had set it up, the tents, and he talks about how like, you know, I'm Lieutenant Charles Ingram III, because that's like his ancestor who was doing this, and he's like, you know, every year we go to Gettysburg and we set up these tents and we reenact the battle, and I'm like, these people are crazy. And then of course I went home and I built a sukkah. So you sort of have to ask yourself like who's crazy and who isn't. You know, and then they're like duchening in the shul, and I'm like, you know, yeah, okay. So, but the point is that I got a little bit tired of all the historical stuff, and I'm like, you know what, I gotta stay away from these reenactors, and I'm just gonna write a contemporary novel. But then when I saw that I was writing about this the software program, and so much of it was about history, the difference between history and memory, I had to test it against something that mattered more than one person's past. This is, I realize, way bigger than your question, but I figured to explain about Schechter. What? You don't mind. She doesn't mind. Okay, good. She's happy. She got her prize, and she's a twin. So thank you. But just to say that. So I knew about the Geniza because, as I mentioned, I'm a nerd. Blah blah. Pros are okay. So I knew that there was a Geniza, and I didn't really know. Like, I knew Schechter had something to do with it. I didn't know anything else about it. Then I went and I found out that it was related to these twins, and I'm like, "Ooh, these twins! I'm like, this is perfect. It's the siblings, the thing." And then I was like going back to look at Schechter, and I'm writing from Schechter's point of view. Schechter's a character in the book. It's from his point of view, and I'm like, I got to learn more about Schechter. I looked at archives in JTS, and also at, there's never been a critical biography of Schechter. There's a hagiography of Schechter, meaning written by one of his friends about how wonderful he is. But yeah, he had a twin, and not only did he have a twin, but his twin was, it was like they both grew up in this Lubavitch village in Romania, and he went west to become an academic in the West, and his brother went to what was then Ottoman Palestine and was one of the founders of Zichron Yaakov. It's like, could this be more perfect? It's even Yaakov. And it's Zichron Yaakov. It's like I couldn't have made this up. And then I started writing about Rambam, and it was like, then I found like one. And Rambam had a brother, and it was this whole, and he was mourning his brother for 8 years. It's like, it was so perfect. But then I wondered if it's like, the thing where, like, you know, like when you're pregnant or your wife is pregnant and suddenly you look around and you're like, oh my God, so many people are pregnant. And it's like if it was just because I was looking for it that I found it, but it was there. And in fact, yes, he was a twin. His twin founded Zichron Yaakov. Yes, now there's more hands. I think you were first because you get a toy.
Is there aspect in your family that you became so involved in researching the Geniza and treatment of asthma?
Yes, this is like a dissertation defense here. These are great questions. It's like you really have to like know to like even just to know what the question is. Yes, is there asthma in my family? She is, just to explain this. She's asking because asthma occurs in this book multiple times. It occurs in the 20s. There's a character who has it in the 21st century. There's a character who has it in the 20th century. There's a character, Solomon Schechter, who has it in the 19th century. And there's a character who has it in the 12th, the Sultan of Egypt. So yes, the boring reason why I included this is, yes, I have 3 of my 4 children have asthma. So this is like not, yeah, this is like not news for me. Clocked a lot of time in the ER. But one of the things that interested me about it was that my husband also had asthma as a child. And my husband's not that old, but yet the way he was treated for his asthma is completely different from the way my children are treated. My children have inhalers and nebulizers, which none of this existed when my husband was a child. He had to get adrenaline shots. Can imagine how great that is to give a 5-year-old boy an adrenaline shot, right? So thank God that's over. Bloodletting, goodbye. Okay, so not that giving them the inhalers has a similar effect, I have to say. But what interested me about this is that this, and then I looked back into like the history of how asthma has been treated, and This is sort of, you know, there's never been any kind of cure, obviously. This is an illness which thankfully is not, you know, is usually not fatal, but it's interesting to me that it's like in every generation there's a new way of treating asthma. And Hippocrates writes about asthma. I mean, all of the ancient physicians write about it, and they all have different ideas of what it is. And so that's what interests, and Rambam has an entire treatise on asthma that he wrote for an unnamed royal patient, who I imagine to be the sultan in my book, although probably was the sultan's son or nephew. And to me, that and Schechter suffered from asthma and talks about it in his memoirs. Of course, you know, like dealing with the 900 years worth of dust was not like really helpful to his illness. And he writes about this, of course. I mean, that was like one of the things that like, you know, led him to take the golden ticket to JTS. Thank you, asthma. And did not spend the rest of his life in the library, in that library. But what interested me is that idea about how everyone thinks they're on the cutting edge of knowledge. And that quest for the cure was interesting to me, because what to me it suggests is this, first of all, for Maimonides being a doctor, being a doctor was in a sense an important part of his theology. And what I mean by that is, if you're living in a world where people believe that illnesses are a result of a divine judgment, like, oh, this is happening to you because you're being punished by God. Well, if somebody then comes along and cures your illness, does that mean you're no longer being punished by God? Like, it's sort of like that kind of throws a monkey wrench into this idea that God's, you know, that God is at work in these things that happen to us. And that was, that monkey wrench, in a sense, is the center of the Guide for the Perplexed, that clash between reason and faith. And what it's interesting to me is that, and Maimonides in Guide for the Perplexed believes that the way that God provides to us is through the intellect. I mean, and there are people in this room, I'm sure, who know this work far better than I do, and the nuances far better than I do. But what he really says is that it's through the intellect that God allows us to protect and provide for each other by giving us the ability to develop a cure for a disease. In other words, this is how God protects us, not by magically curing a disease, but by sending us a smart person who can figure out a cure for a disease. To me, of course, there's a tremendous hubris in this also, because there's this idea that everything is knowable. And it's that sort of chasing after knowledge that you see. And in the book, it happens in each generation, in each century. You see this sort of brilliant person who's chasing that final frontier of knowledge. And it's very perilous when you get to that final edge of knowledge. And that's what a lot of what the book is exploring. Now I'm a lot of toys, so now you just have to ask because you want to know. Yes.
I thought that relationship between Joseph, what learned, and Josie, the daughter, was very interesting book, Jay.
Yes.
That it was the power of forgiveness, that is something that links them. And she has to go through all of this trauma to get to that, and he has to do likewise. And he says to his brothers later on, you know, I forgive you, that you get to follow me. But what puzzled me was why you had a second child born at the end. In other words, if this is...
Spoiler alert! Yeah. That's okay. I have a way I can answer this. It's okay.
Kind of rivalry between siblings continues. You know, you
kind of
left that.
Yes. Sure. So the question is about in a sense something that happens on the very last page of the book. That's okay. No, people ask me about this all the time. So there's on the very last page of the book, there's a suggestion that this conflict between the siblings is being brought into another generation. I'll just leave it at that. You could read this as a very sort of, a devastating and hopeless kind of ending, in that, you know, that this is that, and that would be the way of reading this book, where it's not about free will, where it's about predestination, that this is just something genetic, or this is something that you're born into when you're in this relationship. It's nothing you can do to get out of it. So that would be one way to read it. But throughout the book, there's this kind of double helix of free will and fate. And so that's sort of the part of the double helix that's about destiny, is this idea that maybe she doesn't have, you know, this repetition of this relationship is beyond anyone's ability to prevent. However, this repetition of a relationship follows a situation where, and again, I'm speaking in veiled terms for those who haven't finished the book or haven't read the book yet, the main character presents her relationship with her sister after many events, very dramatic events have occurred between her and her sister, leave it at that. After all these events have occurred, she makes a decision to present her relationship and her experiences with her sister in an entirely positive light. She creates a kind of a false past. And this idea of the false past is something that recurs throughout the book. I should say that actually one of the, there's an early mention of it. There's very small mentions of it throughout the book. This sort of is hint is this idea of this false history and the destructiveness of a false history. One is when there's, in the beginning, when Josie, the software developer, arrives in Egypt and she gets there in October, and a few days after she gets there, there's a national holiday, there are parades in the streets celebrating Egypt's victory in the Yom Kippur War. And the fact that they did not win the Yom Kippur War has no effect on the festivities. And I should say this is a reality. There is actually a national holiday in Egypt that celebrates their victory in the 1973 war. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. So this is sort of the false history that is created. So at the end, this main character creates a false history of her relationship with her sister. And so, and that becomes the relationship that her daughter knows. This is the only, because the daughter, in a sense, remembers some things and doesn't remember others. And the daughter is only, in a sense, is only can see of that past what her mother chooses to show her. She has no other outlet to this past except what her mother chooses to show her. So what you could say is that her relation, so the way that that relationship ends up being repeated, is it because of a destiny and there's no way around it? Or is it because she's been presented with this false history that is, because it's false, is impossible, is sort of set an impossible standard, in a sense, because there's this relationship between sisters that she sees supposedly between her mother and her aunt that is impossible to attain that kind of relationship, so why even try? And perhaps it would have been different if she had known something about the dangers of the relationship that her mother and her aunt really actually had. So I think that double helix of fate and free will is something that sort of spirals down through the book until the very last page. And I've also had readers who said, they're like, but the Joseph story in the Torah like ends happily, you know? And I'm like, well, yeah, except for that part about like hundreds of years of slavery. Like, besides that, it ends happily. I mean, it sort of depends when you stop the story, right? And so the same thing is true in this book, where there's points where you can stop the story where it ends happily. It kind of all depends on which page you stop the story. And so I've spiraled it down sort of to the next generation, to the Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph. Okay. Yes. Yes?
I'd like to know, since you're talking a lot about sisters, and I know you have Jordana and Ariel as your sisters, so I'm curious to know how they responded to these really interesting
oh gosh. let me just put it this way. So she's saying, yes, I have two sisters. I have a brother also. No one remembers him, but I have a brother. I have a brother too. I have two sisters. I am not an autobiographical writer. And the reason I am not an autobiographical writer is because I have been, Kanine Hara, incredibly blessed to have had the kind of life that would make an unbelievably boring novel. So you don't really want to live the kind of life that makes a great novel, right? Think about it. So I have wonderful relationships with my sisters. We write together. We give each other ideas. We edit each other's work. And yeah, this is not a, thankfully, this is not an autobiographical story. So not a concern. Yes, hello.
How do you approach the balance between writing an entertaining novel versus getting across these very complex and profound ideas in the book?
Right. So the question was, how do you balance writing an entertaining novel with getting across these profound ideas in the book? And I guess this is a question I would throw back to the reader, be like, did I? You tell me. I mean, I think that, well, let's put it this way. I mean, to me, the plot is very important. And I would say this. I would say that those two things, I don't see those as separate projects, getting across an important idea and telling an important and exciting story. Because to me, plot is the way that belief is expressed in fiction. And I say this with not just in good fiction, which I hope I'm writing, but in any story any story is a reflection of belief. And here's what I mean by that. And E.M. Forster has a book called Aspects of the Novel, where he talks about what constitutes a plot in a work of fiction. And he gives the example, the sentence, the king died, then the queen died, doesn't have a plot. It's just a sequence of events. But the sentence, the king died, then the queen died of grief, has a plot. Now he says it's because in the second sentence, there's a causative connection between the two events. One event causes the other. I think that's nonsense, because what does it mean to die of grief? You know, did the coroner say you died of grief? Is there like a very clearly articulated suicide note involved here? No. Okay, so if leaving that, you know, aside from those things, what does it mean to say someone died of grief? You couldn't even say that sentence at least, unless you believed, at least while you're saying it, that one person could mean so much to someone else that she couldn't live without him. That's the belief that makes that story possible. And all stories are animated by beliefs. And even like, you know, like crappy action movies, they may not be like, you know, values that you would carry into your regular life. But in fact, like, let's say you have a movie like about an art heist. You know, normally you would not side with a criminal. I hope. Maybe I don't know all of you very well, but normally you wouldn't think to side with a criminal. However, if you're watching a movie from the point of view of the criminal, what has to be set up at the beginning of the movie is the value, a different value that during the time of watching the movie overrides your normal sense that, yeah, committing a crime is bad. So let's say it's that, oh, this guy's a maverick, and like, you know, being independent and being, you know, his ingenuity is what's, you know, that's like the value that this movie is presenting as most important, as opposed to these like stodgy bureaucratic guards or whatever. And so then you're rooting for this guy because you want that value to succeed. So, I mean, and all stories are animated by belief. It's like you can't, it doesn't mean that you have to share the belief reading it, but you have to acknowledge that that belief exists. So you know, you can't read or watch a production of Oedipus Rex without knowing that Oedipus believes in oracles. Doesn't mean that you have to believe in oracles, but you can't be watching and being like, Oedipus is such an idiot. Like, why doesn't he just say, like who cares what the oracle says? Like, no. You know, and the same thing, like, if you're reading the Torah, I mean, you know, even if you're reading it as a secular person, not from not reading it as a believer yourself, you have to acknowledge, like, you can't be like, well, this is so dumb that all these characters are listening to this invisible God. It's like, no, like, while you're reading this book, you have to appreciate that this is what's going on in this book. So all these events are animated by belief. And so to me, the plot is important. Is the plot is not just like, I mean, yes, I try to write. I'm not like a slice of life writer. I'm a writer who cares about plot. I want to keep you entertained at the beach. That's totally true. Please read my book on the beach and enjoy. But I also, the other reason the plot is important to me is because I feel that it's an expression of those ideas. So while I do have some, you know, because less because my books are about ideas than because my books are historical, there sometimes has to be a little exposition of explaining, you know, like people picking up this book, yes, it's called A Guide for the Perplexed, but I'm not like assuming that like somebody buying this in Barnes & Noble is going to like know about the Rambam. So, you know, I have to like, okay, so there's going to have to be like a paragraph explaining who the Rambam is. Okay, fine. Okay, but like other than that, I think that, you know, and for that, I mean, in other words, those ideas I think I have to explain because they're historic, because you need to give people the context. Fine. You know, we don't, I wish we lived in a culture where everybody knew who the Rambam was, but we don't. But other than that, I think that, you know, the beliefs, the ideas that are expressed in the story are expressed through the story. At least I aspire to do that, so my readers may disagree. But should we do one more?
One more.
Okay, yes.
Following on the comment you made, how many of your books, all of them, this one, all of them, been received by general reading audience? When you speak to non-Jewish groups, thousands of books, when you book talk, how are your books received on these very Jewish topics?
Sure, that's a very good question. So the question was, how are my books received by a non-Jewish audience? That's a short version of the question. I would say that when I first started writing these books, when I was writing my first novel, which also, for those who haven't read it, deals a lot with these kinds of themes and in a very serious way. You know, to the extent that I thought that, like, anybody would read it other than my mom. You know, like, you know, you hope that someone besides your mom will read it. But other than that, I kind of, like, assumed that this was a novel for Jewish readers. And my editor, who bought this book, who bought my first novel and also who I've still been working with for all four novels, is not Jewish. And I remember the first time I ever, and she's the one who decided to publish me. And I remember the first time I ever spoke with her on the phone. I asked her what her background was. And what I meant by that question was, what is your background in publishing? You know, like, how do you mostly work with fiction or nonfiction? How long have you been with this publishing house? And I will always remember this. She paused on the phone and she says, well, I'm Italian-American. I'm a lapsed Roman Catholic. And I'm like so embarrassed that she thinks this is what I asked her. I've never met her before. And then she says, you know, I read this book and I felt like I was reading about my own life and my own family. And I was like, how's that possible? and she said, being Italian-American, feeling like I'm from this culture that there's this, you know, it's a foundation of Western civilization, it's this vastly rich you know, legacy of in literature and art and music, but feeling like I'm separated from it by a country I don't live in, by a language I don't use, and feeling like every aspect of that culture that's here in the United States is just like this sort of kitschy, almost painful stereotypes of that culture that has like almost nothing to do with that culture really is. She said, you know, and being a lapsed Roman Catholic, feeling like I'm part of this like majestic religious tradition that is, you know, it's meant so much to so many generations of people, but and that it's meant so much to me as well, but that I can't fully embrace as a modern person, but it has this long shadow, I can't fully leave it. She says, I just felt like I was reading about my own life. And I have to say that I underestimated my readers when I first started writing these books. Because I did have this idea. I remember going to a bookseller's convention, also for my first book. It was Southeast Booksellers Association. So booksellers from all over the southeastern United States. It was in Fort Lauderdale. I figure I'm going to this thing to sell this to Jewish ladies in Miami because who else here is going to buy my book? And I remember they had us do this stupid speed dating thing where you had to like sit at a table of 10 booksellers. And there were like 50 authors, 50 tables. They would sit at a table, they would ring a bell, you'd have 2 minutes to pitch your book, and then they'd move you to the next table. And they had everybody wearing a name tag with the name of their store, the name, their name, and like the town where they were from. And I look around the first table, I'm like, Jewish ladies from Miami, we're cool. I talk about my book. And I get to the next table, they ring the bell, it's my second table, I look around and it's Arkansas, 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 Arkansas. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, this is not gonna be good. And I'm like, I got like 10 seconds to think, I'm like, how am I gonna pitch this book to these people? What am I gonna say to them? And then they're all like looking at me like this, and I'm like, my book has a lot of biblical themes. And they're like, biblical themes? And I have to tell you, I am very frequently invited to churches. I speak often at churches. I speak at Christian seminaries. Because those people know the Bible. The Jewish readers don't know the Bible. Those people really know the Bible. I mean, I have to tell you, there are many, many more Christian readers that have picked up biblical references in my book than Jewish. So, I mean, this is not a concern. Not a concern. And I have to say that, I mean, it's kind of sad, but it's not a concern. And also, I would say, like, what I've learned, really, is that, and my books are published in other languages in, like, you know, places like Norway, where, like, you know, it's not like Jewish readers are really buying my book, because there's, like, 5 Jews in Norway. Maybe all 5 of them bought it, but, yeah, I sold more than 5 books in Norway. So somebody else is reading my book. So I have to say that, like, and I do speak of these Christian audiences. I mean, and they see these as books that are about scripture and books that are about belief. And that's really what they are. And I think that I had underestimated the power of literature, in a sense, because what literature is about is communication. It's about what it's like to be in someone else and having that experience. And I think that there's something very beautiful happens when you publish a book, because you write one book, but then everyone who's reading your book is reading a different book from the book that you wrote, which is actually turns out to be a wonderful thing, because they're often reading a better book than the book that you wrote. Thank you so much.
Okay. To begin with, I know that only 2 of you got the toys, but we all won the prize thanks to the generosity of the presentation. I do have to thank my partner in setting up these events, Hector Guzman, who's over here, who helps to make it possible. And I want to draw your attention to the fact that the JTS is the home of many, many wonderful cultural events of various sorts. So please check out our schedules. The banner on the top of our homepage has got a full schedule of what's coming up, including more of our book talks. So please do check it and come back. Books are still for sale outside, and the author is here to sign. Thank you for coming. Very animated,
very non-reverential. Good night. Nice to see you, Marcia.
Is there a staircase down this way, or?
There is, or you can even walk down this way as well, but...
Could it take us to Broadway this way?
This is, yeah. If you...
You're looking for steps, she's not the elevator?
Steps, yeah. If you go through here, go down one floor, you'll get to a little exhibition area, then just make a right.
That way.
Did you take the recording? The recorder? Yeah, okay.
I have it here.
There you go.
This was absolutely wonderful.
Thank you for coming. Tell me you helped her move it.
Yeah, we moved it on, just to make sure, yeah.
I'll move it back when they're done.
No, wait.
I'll move it back. If you need to go there, I can move. I can drive.
No, it should be the last month.
Just so that...
That's the best I have ever heard.
No, but you will enjoy it more now. Definitely. Sure. Well, thanks for coming.
Yeah, you could see her with a baby spit and vomit on her. She would be nonplussed, you know?
No, it's funny. Her family sounds like very interesting. Yeah. Sort of nightmarish in its way.
Yeah, so she said, I wouldn't recommend this.
Oh, my God.
Bye.
Great to see you. Thanks for coming.
Yeah. As soon as I saw it posted, I called Carol. I said, we have to go. Call.
Have you heard before?
Yes, I have.
Oh, I didn't see. I had no idea.
I heard at the Center for Jewish History.
Oh, okay. And, so there you go.
I wasn't going to miss this show.
Yeah, it is a show. It's true.
She's very witty. She's very entertaining.
Right. Right. All those things.
Oh,
exactly.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
She's in Peabody.
Yes, right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I even saw Arnie Eisen smile. He never...
Was he here?
He was here. He and Asa were...
They were here?
He was sitting there in the second row, and his wife was sitting in the last row.
I didn't see them.
They came in with Mark Aaron.
When did they come in? Oh.
They came in after you started speaking.
Oh, I had no idea. I didn't see them. That's funny. I saw Mark. I mean, yeah. I didn't even know they were here.
They came in with Mark.
Did they leave early too?
They left as soon as the question started.
I didn't see them at all. I guess it's because I was facing this way.
You were facing this way, and he was a kind of very, he was on the edge there, second row. Wow.
But he did he come in before my introduction?
No. No, he came at the time that Mark Garrick. He came in with Mark Garrick.
Okay, I had no idea. Okay.
So maybe his wife dragged him. Maybe his wife had him.
He often leaves early from these events, I've noticed.
Yeah, you have noticed. No, even staff assemblies. Who is that person with Lucia? Is that her? Who's that person with Lucia? Is that her?
It's, I think, her boyfriend.
Oh, okay. Isn't that unusual to bring him to?
That was weird.
It was weird.
Today to the meeting, yeah. I have no idea what that was about. I'd met him before, but I don't care.
Is he her editor or what?
I don't know. Does he edit her? I don't know.
Is she from the Middle East? Or
No. She's from Argentina, maybe. Something.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to remember where she's from. South America, I think.
Yeah, maybe Argentina, that would fit in.
But she's funny. She's got very radical ideas about Israel, and she's managed to find a way to express them here, but she feels challenged and sometimes embattled over it. So I didn't know this quite by accident. The first class she came to here was mine. She took an opening seminar, and in that seminar, it was a seminar on space and place in Judaism. And so I wanted to, show how, space can be manipulated and boundaries and ideologies and so forth. And so I presented some pages from something called the Atlas of the Conflict, which is a very comprehensive atlas of what's going on in Israel in their domination of the Palestinians. And the wars and so forth. I'll show it to you. I've got it in my office. And she was so shocked that someone would use that. She said to me today, she says, I heard that. I said, I found a friend. It was very funny because she expected something quite different.
What did you think of Amos Gitai's series?
I thought the series was terrible, actually. What about you?
I was so pissed off at the whole thing with it took them...
I thought it was terrible because I thought it was an interesting conception and the individual pieces were nice, but the panel discussions were ill-prepared, not well-conceived, and just stupid.
I gather he's very much a diva. He's very much very high-maintenance.
It wasn't sensitive to who he was. It was, for the audience, it wasn't defined well what the conversations were supposed to be.
Okay.
Honestly, it's because we've organized by Alan Cooper, and Alan Cooper is a person of great ideas and miserable execution. Just miserable.
Yeah.
I mean, and so anything you entrust to anything that he's in charge of, it's just like, the ball's going to be dropped.
Okay. Because Richard Pena was the...
but he actually wasn't good in that position. He wasn't a good... a good moderator. Yeah. Because he was a film person, and
he's a film academic.
It wasn't about film. It was about archaeology. People who design buildings. Architecture, yeah. I had archaeology in my head. It was about architecture.
Yeah.
And it was about urban planning.
It wasn't about film.
Yeah. And it was just so stupid to have him be the person who did it. You needed someone who would direct it in that direction.
Oh, so that was really ill-conceived.
Yeah, it was just like poor.
Wow.
Poor.
Okay.
So he's in charge of this arts council. They've got this thing with beauty is fabulous. I mean, it's just, they have one coming up after she's finished with this quote-unquote photographer who does photos of beautiful trees. Like he's done, coffee table books for the New York Botanical Garden. It's not art. I mean, to represent, it's pretty and as boring as can be. It's literally not art, and he's not an artist, and it's so poor. Hi, I'm good. How about you?
Good.
Good. Is that where you are in the book?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So you're
getting this book. You really could sit down and,
just go through it. It's very quick. Yeah.
I don't know if I got used to his style. This is the fourth one that I read.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know if I got used to his style.
Or if it's
at
maybe
the beginning, I did. Now I know she's just following three threads.
Right.
Three storylines. Mm-hmm. But at the beginning, when she went on to something, I thought I missed.
Oh, you thought you did the transition.
So
yeah.
I spent an absolute half hour.
Oh no, trying
for
to figure out what it was.
So now I'm going to read.
Now you'll just go.
But,
yeah.
She puts such interesting material in. Really
yeah, yeah,
appeals
very
to
much,
someone
very much,
with
sure.
a conservative background,
sure.
Jewish background.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really
yeah. I didn't know about Selma Schachter's brother. I had no idea.
That he went to
and it's
found,
so fascinating. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good description of his brother. Yeah. Yeah.
I know a couple in, actually, I don't know them well, but the wife babysat for my granddaughter, mm-hmm. my first granddaughter of that child of mine, mm-hmm. my son, and her husband is either the grandson or the child of one of the Ginsburgs, either Louis Ginsburg.
Oh yeah, there are a lot of Ginsburgs around. Actually.
No, who's the one who Legend of the Jews?
Yeah, Ginsburg. Ginsburg. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've got library supporters who are from the Ginsburg
so
family.
So I think he's the son, his son. Did he have, there were twins involved.
I don't know. I don't remember the connections.
I don't remember.
I know.
Gould is the
yeah,
his
yeah,
name.
Yeah, yes, that's a Gould family. That's,
yeah,
that's,
Gould.
Yeah,
that's right, exactly. That's right.
So Louis Ginsburg
there's
had
David
the twins.
Gould. I don't remember.
And this one's John Gould.
Yeah.
So that must be it.
Yes.
For a minute, I thought it was Schachter. But I asked my son,
no, no,
and he
yeah,
said,
"Yeah, that's
Gould.
Right. That's cool.
So
that's right.
Yeah, that's
interesting. Yeah. Is this Ginsburg, Louis Ginsburg, the one he used to flip his tie over his shoulder? He taught
know.
In Pro Store. There
I
were two
know.
Ginsburgs.
Taught him again. Pro Store.
There was H.L. Yeah. Ginsburg, which is spelled with an S.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah, H.L. was a Bible person.
Yeah, he didn't have children, right?
That's
no, H.L. Ginsburg.
He used to take. I was in Pro Store.
Oh, he really.
So he used to take his tie and flip it the entire time.
Really. He was a very sweet guy.
Yeah, very nice. I once stayed, I was in LTF.
Right.
So they had kibbutzim.
Right,
so one
right,
time
sure.
it was at the seminary, and I stayed with the Ginsburgs.
Oh, that must have been fun.
For the Shabbat. Yeah, it was nice. But that's when you're young, you don't really pick up on
sure.
yeah,
most
of
what's going
know
on
it, yeah.
because
yeah.
it has no context.
Right. H.L. Ginsburg actually was the, he joined Arminian at the end of his life.
Yeah.
He came to Arminian, and so we saw him every week. He was wow. great.
What, he lived in New Jersey?
No, he lived here.
Oh, here. Oh.
He lived here. H.L. Ginsburg lived.
Yeah, he lived over on like 103rd Street
yes.
or 110th Street,
yes.
Closer to Riverside.
That's right.
Because I remember staying there.
That's where most of them lived. Dr.
Right.
Lieberman, Dr. Finkelstein lived on 106 on Riverside. Yeah, so they're within that, those
well,
few yeah, blocks.
I don't know if he lived on Riverside.
No, it was
I
kind of.
I think he was between Broadway
and
Riverside.
West End.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most of them, Dr.
I'm so glad you mentioned it because for years now I've been trying to figure out who was who.
Yeah.
So H.L. is the one I'm talking about. And Louis Ginsburg is the one who wrote Legend of the Jews.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Thank you so much for clarifying. Yes. This is great.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, it's probably the best book person I've ever heard.
Oh, really? Yeah, no, she's really very... Very animated.
Very animated.
Very
brilliant.
Smart. Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. We're just talking about our devices, and I have her book on my iPad.
Lovely.
So I'm excited to be reading it.
Good. Enjoy it.
Yeah.
Take care. Thank you for coming.
Yeah. I've been here a few times. My favorite space.
Yeah, there's something very nice about this space.
I'm still Professor Collins, but I've been through the library program. Yeah, it's great. It's great.
Yeah.
talk a long time in the library. There's actually a book. Well, if you're enrolled. Okay. Yeah, they're really picky there. Yeah. Like, my parents came to visit me and they would not let them in. They would not. They were like, my parents, my mom, like, tried to, like, sneak in, like, type up, pick up her visitor tags. They were mad. Yeah, they're not very That was a revelatory experience because that was really where I found the answers that I was looking for that hadn't been in any of the, there were a couple biographies of him that didn't have what I was looking for. I was basically looking for like his relationships with these artists that he saved after the war. I was in college, I graduated in 99, and I finished the PhD in 2006, so that was like the years during which this changed in terms of like what was accessible online. And what the librarians there used to say, and I don't know if they still feel this way, what they used to say is that they said, people don't need us less, they need us more. They said, because people come to us with much more detailed questions. In other words, because by the time you go bother with a librarian, it's after you already have exhausted so many other paths, where before you would have started with the librarian.
And so in a sense, there's like a much deeper level. Of course, this is Harvard, you know, I mean, this is not like your local library. I mean, people are doing serious scholarship.
Library, have you been to Cairo?
I have been to Cairo as a tourist. So, like, I was there for like a few days. I was in Alexandria for a few days. And so I was very nervous.
You were there in preparation for writing this book?
No. I mean, like, they're having a war there, you know? How's it going? I had been there like, you know, 10 or 15 years ago as a tourist, just for a few days. And so I was very nervous about writing the parts of the book that are contemporary Egypt. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who, I was doing my doctorate in Yiddish and Hebrew. She was doing hers in Arabic. And she now teaches at Ben Gurion in Israel, and she's in Arabic literature. And she figured out that as a blonde, blue-eyed Ashkenazi Jewish woman who is like not anti-Israel, vocally anti-Israel, this is the only place she could get a job teaching Arabic literature was in Israel. So sadly, she had lived in Cairo for years. She like I sent her the manuscript, and I was like, does this sound like it is plausible? And is anything egregious here? And she was like, this is a very negative portrayal of Egypt, and I hate to say it, but it rings very true. I was like, well, I'm sorry. So, I'm sorry, I'm supposed to
be Shira.
Shira.
Good night, Kira. Thank you so much.
This is wonderful. Oh,
yeah, it's great that you could come. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm helping her get out.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
All right, just good to meet you. Thank you.
Hold that elevator.
Okay, for sure.
Thank you.
Do you have a period or something that you were specialized in the archive?
No, I mean, I'm working on one person. Like, okay. 20th century professor at JPS.
Okay, who is it?
Joanna Spector.
Okay,
I don't remember this.
I was having a friend who wrote a dissertation on the Finkel study.
Right.
That's why I was curious.
My interests are in older French history, so it's a little far from that. But it's a plan for reconstructing her life and choosing what to remember and choosing what not to. It's a big decision.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's, you know, you do that in fiction, but the truth is that anytime you're telling a story, you're making those creative decisions. I mean, there is an objective reality, there is an objective past, but there's no objective way of looking at the past.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's always a creative. Yes. And it becomes your story. Yes.
Internally. Thank you so
nice
much.
To meet you. Thank you. Thank you.
You put that so well in the book.
Patient people.
You're welcome. She's one of my favorite authors.
So
wonderful. Have you read her?
You know, when I was reading the book, and got to Rob Howard,
it was very
for like cerebral friction, it just
quickly. I enjoyed that.
Oh, thank you. Because a lot of people
thank you for
your
service
in order
to make
it.
And then it was
take care. Have a good night.
Oh, thank you.
In case you still need to wear your whistle.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. You want me to date also? Or
no, I'll add a personal description myself. And this was a wonderful quote I wrote down at the time I read.
I
give it to you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yes, no one is ever forgiven for losing a war.
No, it's...
Although the Egyptians
have
forgiven
I listened to your comments about the holiday, yeah.
Yes, that was amazing to me. And when I wrote that, I didn't really think of it that way, and then it was like only later
that, it's,
that I was like, yeah, this is the false history.
Yeah,
and
no, it's very true.
Yeah.
of course I had to lose the style. That's the point I did, right?
Yes.
You'd be the big winner at some point.
I wanted to show this year. I used it as a bookmark, maybe for 10 years in the position.
Oh, wow.
Which I thought of at the time.
Yes,
I was reading your book. I thought if you sign it, I'd look at it literally every
sure,
day.
Sure, sure. Should I write a note to you or something?
No, it's okay. Just nice to have.
Okay. Me and Fidel. I'll help you.
I was going to ask you, I saw somebody do this, which is they asked the author to sign their photo at the back.
Wacky. Okay, sure.
I brought a pen.
Oh, wow. That
wooden smear.
So sophisticated.
Or where in the white
yeah,
space.
Yeah, for sure.
And,
right.
But I thought that was really cool.
Sure. You can see me aging.
Well, that didn't occur to me.
Everyone's like, why don't you just use the photo from last time? I'm like, because I'm like 3 years older than last time.
Now,
at some point, that's
going to
like, I don't want to become like the horror story of like, you know, suddenly I change all the photos like 10 years from now. And everyone's
well,
like,
yeah, you have kids, so if you don't age, really. And I wanted to thank you for, this is a book I read. I don't.
Oh, yes, of course. Well, of course I read it anyway, because I.
Well, you know, that's the interesting
thing. But that doesn't always mean that I read
it. I wasn't familiar with the author.
Yes.
I was in the store reading the blurbs, and I saw this wonderful, I knew
yeah.
two of the people, you
yes.
and Dr. Grootman.
Yes.
And it was such an interesting read.
Yeah, it's a good book. I actually met her in this building.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, they were on some panel that, I don't know, we were consulting GTS about something.
I thought if you'd be willing to sign the blurb,
sure.
I thought it's
sure.
just
why
a
not?
Nice,
sure, why not?
A nice memento, but it's a very interesting subject.
Thank you.
And thank you so
yeah,
much for your historical
oh, thank you. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. Thank you.
That was wonderful.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I know, I have all the people afterward, they said this was the best book club they've ever attended.
Oh, wow. Here or just in general? I mean,
in general.
Wow. I'm very honored. Thank you.
These women, they probably have gone to quite a few.
Yes, right.
And they invariably said this was the best they've heard.
Oh, thank you for telling me.
What a pleasure to meet you. You present this so animatedly and so... It's so different from the dry, kind of normal delivery that we have in our book talks.
Oh, I don't know what you usually have, so.
But
thank you.
It was just very, very lovely. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a privilege to be here.
Thank you.
Really, it was an honor, and it was just like this perfect audience for this subject.
You honored us. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care.
Are you going home to New Jersey now? How are you getting
yeah,
home?
Yeah, well, I'm hoping to get a taxi to Penn Station.
Oh, that's not a problem.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
not going to be harder. Maybe if I have to walk a little bit toward Columbia to do that, or should I
you can get it right here. Just cross until you go to the downtown side. You'll get a cab in no time.
Okay. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Right.
Safe home, and thanks again.
Thank you.
Hi.
This is the route to your door?
Okay.
You can even find your way in the dark.
Yeah.
Good night.